We present the news quiz with your host, Miles Jupp.
Hello and welcome to the news quiz. We start with a cutting from the Bristol Post, read by Susan Ray.
A man in his 40s remains in hospital after suffering injuries when he was shot twice in the Jolly Roger in the early hours of Saturday.
Thanks to Tom Bland in Bristol for sending in that little bit of naughty. Now, let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first, on my right, Andy Hamilton and Susan Kalman. And opposite them, on my left, senior political correspondent at BuzzFeed, Emily Ashton and Ellis James. So, Andy, what is the only red thing that Jeremy Corbyn doesn't like?
Yeah, well, it's Jeremy Corbyn. He's been worrying me this week quite a lot. It worried me because whenever he got up and called for an end to sniping, name-calling abuse, I thought, yeah, that's my living you're talking about there. Stay off my patch, beardy. in the spirit of the newer kind of politics, I'll say he had a pretty good week at conference until possibly the last day when he said that if he became Prime Minister, he would never push the nuclear button. And that was until his shadow cabinet then said that they thought that in certain circumstances they would push his hand onto the button. I think roughly how it would work. But, I mean, if he ends up being Prime Minister, but the party have voted to keep Trident, it will be tricky because there's no point having a nuclear deterrent unless you're prepared to use that crucial element of bluff. And Jeremy Corbyn doesn't seem like the kind of... Well, I'll put it the kindest way I can. I shouldn't imagine he's very good at poker. I think it's probably a case of, you know, you got a strong hand, Jeremy? Nah. Oh, look for yourself. But I mean, Trident, it's going to continue to be divisive because it is indefensibly expensive. But at the same time, people are worried. It's an uncertain world. Sometimes they worry that they need a deterrent. I think I might have come up with a solution, which is, I think, if the policy was that we don't have nuclear weapons, but that we pretend that we do. That seems to be a win-win for everyone.
Well, we could still have a red button, couldn't we?
We have all of that.
Could not be attached to
it. It wouldn't be hard. We build fake missiles out of cardboard or recycled plastic or whatever, you know, nice and big, so they show up on Putin's satellite photos. Mysterious convoys going up and down. Fake the occasional accident. Fence off whales.
BBC are always telling me to press the red button on my remote control. Is that linked in any way to this discussion? I thought that was just to get the extras from Strictly Come Dancing, but now I'm thinking there might be something else going on.
In fairness to him, like, I wouldn't press the nuclear button. I don't even like turning the immersion heater on. I mean, so the nuclear button is a big deal. And also, he's campaigned against it for 40 years, so it would be insane for a journalist to say, would you press the nuclear button, and for him to go, to be honest, now it's actually a possibility. Yeah. I fancy it, actually.
So I watched the conferences, and I just... we were all waiting for Corbyn, and there's been a lot of discussion about his stand-up that he did at the start of his speech, which was... I mean, it's nice, but part of me also wanted to hear some policy.
Emily, I mean, we're rank amateurs. You were there this week at the Labour Party conference. So which Labour MP looked sort of most awkward throughout the whole thing?
Well, the ones that would have felt awkward weren't there. Yeah. Chuck Rumina, Tristram Hunt, Mary Cray, they all got on a train right before the speech because they did not want to be sitting in the audience with cameras trained on their faces as they clapped. Oh, well done. The funny thing was, in the evenings of this conference, you have endless parties.
Who are the really big drinkers? I mean, who behaves like... Yeah. And I'm not after tittle-tattle here, but... don't even think about naming names. But I mean, yes. Who do you watch?
Everybody.
I cannot believe you are a serving MP. You are an animal.
I couldn't name any individual, literally any MP.
Can you not remember? Because we can.
That's probably it.
We can do hypnotherapy if you fancy. I think it was an interesting conference to see, as you say, who wasn't there. Andy Burnham was very, very supportive. It looked to me like he was smiling and clapping away, happy as you like. But the people that weren't there are the ones who are actually quite interesting to see what they do next, I suspect.
How did it go down in the room, Burnham, his speech?
Quite well, but everybody in the room was quite supportive of whoever was on stage, so it wasn't really a good test.
Is it a bit like an AA meeting, is it? Just everyone... Yeah. Everyone's just kind of rooting for them all the time. It's just like... I mean, I think the phenomenon of Jeremy Corbyn is really interesting, but I have to say I was a little bit disappointed about how conventional the speech was. I mean, one of the first things he did was the thing that every leader does, which is attempt to define Britishness as part of their patriotism. And he came out with what they all come out with, which is, oh, we're unique... You know, we're a caring, kind nation. We don't walk past on the other side, you know. And I thought, really? I walk past the same beggars every day on Oxford Street. And tens of thousands of people do it as well. They can't all be tourists. You know, there was this kind of mythology thing. And then...
But wouldn't you have felt personally a bit demoralised if Corbyn had opened his speech by saying, by the way, Andy Hamilton doesn't give money to beggars?
No, but I just wish that...
I mean, that would have been...
Yeah.
I mean, just for him to single you out would have been unfair, obviously, but in terms of...
But, you know, there was that. And also when he... I thought he also got his definition of Britishness very out of kilter, because at one point he said British people don't have to accept what they're given. Well, that's the essence of being British. That's why, yeah. That's why we don't send food back in restaurants. Yeah. You know, so if he's going to advocate making a fuss, he's going to come across as very unpatriotic.
The one thing that genuinely defines Britishness is the Great British Bake Off. There is no question. That is, if you were trying to explain what it's like to be British, that is the programme, because it's multicultural, it's full of innuendo, and people cry over pastry. And that is, in essence, what it is to be British.
It would be great if he did it, if he summed up Britishness in quite a bleak way. Yeah. For me, Britishness, I mean, a lot of us are quite bad in the morning. a lot of us have got quite rubbish broadband. to be honest, I hate being British. It's absolutely rubbish, just like each and every one of you. Thank you very much.
But he was told to do that because there's this whole kind of idea that he's some form of communist that hates the country and he wants to overthrow capitalism. So I don't think it's wrong that he had necessarily parts of the speech that had previously been written for Miliband in it before, because I think in political speech writing they do recycle ideas. So that's not the problem. It's just that I really did want something completely different, it wasn't actually that different.
With that, because he was accused of plagiarism, because the same political speech writer, is it Richard Heller, is that his name?
Heller,
he's offered this bit of text to every Labour leader since Neil Kinnock, and they've all turned it down. And then Corbyn sort of thought, yes, please. But then Can't Get You Out of My Head is the most successful single of the 2000s, and that was turned down by S Club 7 and Sophie Ellis-Bextor. So, you know, I think he made quite a good...
I mean, easily overlooked.
Yeah, if he'd combined that speech with Hot Pants, the mind boggles.
But what he should have done with that passage to explain it is, you know, with his PMQs and he's asking people, please write in, you know, and I will read out your question. He should have just started his speech. This speech was sent in by Richard from London.
I'll tell you the other thing that I thought was depressingly conventional was the slogan. Because I thought if he had genuinely a new kind of politics, don't have a slogan. But he did, and he chose...
Let's have a big banner up that says, well, here we all are.
But if you're going to have a slogan, I mean, he chose straight talking, honest politics. If you're going to choose a slogan, don't choose one that will turn around and bite you in the arse, which is what that will do. Because what it means is, whenever he is evasive or disingenuous, which he'll have to be because he's Labour leader, there will be moments when he has to do that, then that will be thrown straight back in his face. He should not have had a slogan. He should have had a picture of some kittens or something like that.
What about his sort of basic skills then? I mean, what about his use of the auto cue? How did
that work? Yes, there's a slight cock-up, wasn't there, because he read the words "strong message here" like it was part of his speech. So.
Jeremy Tony was very lucky because although he read it, it sort of made sense.
Yeah.
And he read it as if it made sense. He went, strong message here, didn't he? I mean, it could have been a lot worse. It could have been, you know, we must invest in young people and lean forward sincerely.
Astoundingly, these are the latest antics of Jeremy Corbyn, either the people's friend or a defrosted member of the 1950s Soviet Politburo. It all depends on what papers you read. This week, Corbyn provoked criticism from members of his own shadow cabinet after saying that he would not be prepared to use nuclear weapons, which is either a brave stand in support of peace or a craven surrender to his sinister paymasters in the Kremlin. Again, it all depends very much on which papers you read. The basic idea behind Trident is to deter a nuclear attack on the UK, as we would be able to launch a retaliatory strike on the aggressor, a concept known as mutually assured destruction. Three words very much on the minds of those attending the Labour Party conference. Corbyn, the Open University 1978 Lecturer of the Year, open brackets, runner-up, delivered his first speech to Labour Party conference this week. Journalists revealed that Corbyn's speech had been copied and pasted from a speech appearing on a website, although suspicions had been aroused in the hall when he thanked the bridesmaids, read out some telegrams from people who couldn't make it, and made a tearful toast to someone called Terry and Siobhan. I'm not that keen on borrowing from other writers. In fact, I would go so far as to say that I have a dream that one day on the Red Hills of Georgia... the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. But, you know, that is just what I think. Several big-name Labour MPs missed the speech altogether, but they said they'd be able to catch up on it simply by watching an old episode of Citizen Smith. Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell also spoke to conference and set out his plans for the economy, promising that his speech would be quite boring. Not since Caligula said things might get a little fruity has a promise been so unequivocally delivered. 2 points to Andy. Susan, who was late for assembly but early to the battlefield?
This is a question about Syria, the comedy question all of us were hoping to get. So, it was the 70th UN General Assembly. Big Baz Obama turned up, Big Vlad turned up a bit later, and they were talking about a lot of things, but Syria was one of the points they were talking about, and Big Baza said he wanted a considered and tactical regime change from Assad in Syria, which essentially means they want rid of him. If your boss says they're tactically considering your position, I think that means you're fired. And so Putin and Obama actually shook hands at one point, and if you watch the video, it's an extraordinary one. It's like if you meet someone when they're coming out of the toilet and you have to shake their hand and you go, ah. It was a very limp and very brief handshake between them. So everyone goes away thinking, that was a good party, we've done well there. The American embassy in Baghdad receives a message saying in 1 hour, Russia is going to start bombing Syria. And so what's happened since then is that Russia has started bombing Syria ostensibly to target IS groups. That's what they're saying they're doing. America has said, we don't think that's what you're doing. We think you're actually doing something different to support Assad. And Russia's answer, which I think is the most glorious political answer I've ever heard, they just went, prove it. And the UN General Assembly again proves itself, if I'm very honest, to be fairly ineffective in actually controlling anything that goes on in the world.
The photo said it all, didn't it, at the UN General Assembly of between Putin and Obama. I think when Obama walked into that room to shake Putin's hand, I think the whole thing lasted about 13 seconds. He was in, handshake, out, like the fastest ever. And when they were around this big old table with all the world leaders, Obama left Putin till last to clink his glass.
Well,
that was
the first
really
time around,
message.
He didn't actually clink it, did he? They had to. Putin was offering his glass like a sort of girl at a prom, you know. And Obama didn't go around that far. He had to go back for it, yeah.
And Obama must have thought, oh, you know, I really showed him, yeah, didn't I? Yeah. And then an hour later, what's he done?
That's probably the moment where Putin thought, right, I'm invading Syria. Yeah. But I thought it was very unlucky timing for Jeremy Corbyn that on the day he determines his pacifist position, Putin decides to go on tour with his Cold War tribute act. But the situation, I mean, it's awful. It's a terrible story.
Yeah.
But there's always a darkly comic moment in there somewhere. And I would love to have been a fly on the wall. It was a general, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Had to go up to the military headquarters in Baghdad, ring the doorbell, bing, bong. Vladimir Putin, he probably said to him, look, go around there, tell them we're going to... But say please. Just because we're bombing people doesn't mean we have to forget our manners. And they had to get their bomb. I mean, it's quite scary. It'll all calm down once Trump is president, obviously.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Because you used to work at or for the UN.
I worked at the UN. I worked at the United Nations in Geneva. And it's a really interesting, strange place. They sell lovely prawn rolls.
All right.
Which were delicious. But it was £8 for a rum and coke.
Ooh.
And I think that's just wrong.
Well, we've heard some shocking things tonight.
It was a weird, strange place. And I smoked a lot. And I drank a lot of gitane. I smoked a lot, drank a lot. I used to play chess with old men in the park. And they
didn't you have chess pieces?
No.
Startlingly, this story is of how Russia leapfrogged over UN General Assembly and started its own bombing campaign against Syria, targeting what it claims are IS strongholds in the country. Russia claimed it attacked IS terrorists rather than rebel-held territories, that Assad is part of the solution rather than the problem, and that polonium is a refreshing and welcome addition to any ex-KGB informer's cup of tea. An hour before the strikes began, a Russian general left his country's embassy in Baghdad, knocked on the door of the American one round the corner and said, you'd better move your planes, we start bombing in an hour. And people say we don't talk to our neighbours anymore. 2 points to Susan. Ellis, have a listen to this. Ellis, which new parenting law may be a puff piece?
I think this is about the story that the law's changed. So you can no longer, it's no longer legal to smoke in the car if you have an under 18 present. It's a £50 fine, and it now reduces the places in the UK where it's acceptable to smoke to sitting on your own toilet, out at sea, and the top of Snowdonia, but not in the little cafe. So, smoking in a car with kids in it's been banned, meaning that teenagers get another perk when they turn 18. They can finally passively inhale mum and dad's smoke. It's only a £50 fine. I thought it'd be more, but the police have said that they're initially going to take a non-confrontational approach, very much like their attitude to rich paedophiles in the last three decades. But you'd have to be an absolute lunatic to take up smoking now. You know, unless you're addicted to standing outside offices in the rain, why on earth would you take up smoking? So it's ironic, I always think, because the ideal smoker nowadays is actually quite outdoorsy. So, yeah, it's a £50 fine if you're caught smoking in the car with children in the car.
And it's a £50 fine that the police have said they won't really...
Yeah, there's going to be a sort of goodwill period of at least 3 months where they'll give you a sort of a ticking off, and then they're just going, Yeah.
Do they need to be your own children? Because I don't have any. I was just wondering if I had other people's children in the car.
Yeah, no, I think
I
that would be an offence. Yeah.
Would it?
Yeah. I thought,
I would ask the parents, I wouldn't just take children.
No, that would be another offence.
Would that be another offence?
I think they'd take a dimmer view of that than smoking.
Do you think?
Yeah.
I don't know which one they'd ignore first.
Well, I'm just wondering which would be worse. Whether it's the stealing children or the smoking that they would concentrate on, because it's important to know.
I got a bit narked about this story because for a couple of reasons. One was the police, are they allowed to cherry pick which things are serious and which aren't? I mean, it is quite serious for a kid if they're sitting every day inhaling, you know, noxious fumes. And if it's a Volkswagen, they're getting a double whammy.
Promisingly, these are the new powers the police have to issue on-the-spot £50 fines to people smoking in cars carrying children, which seems reasonable, though I'm not sure why they shouldn't put up with smoke when adults have to put up with their incessant and, I have to say, somewhat infantile babble. The police have said that they won't be strictly enforcing the ban, but will take a non-confrontational attitude, which sounds rather like Jeremy Corbyn's plans for the armed forces. I have to say, the police come in for a lot of stick on this programme, but I think they do a great job, even if, as this story makes clear, they only do it occasionally. Brilliantly, if in England you do want to smoke in a car with your children present, it has to be in an open-topped car, so unbearable people don't need to worry. Smoking is still allowed, however, in cars in Northern Ireland and Scotland, where it's considered a vital way of keeping baby warm during the winter.
And summer.
Emily, who's Jamaican plans for a new prison?
Well, I think I know what you've done there. Because David Cameron was in the Caribbean this week. He made a trip to the UN first in New York, and then he hot-footed it to Jamaica. The first trip, I think, by a British Prime Minister for 14 years to Jamaica. So he went there to pledge millions on building a prison so that Jamaican prisoners here can be deported to this very modern prison out there, because apparently they can't be deported at the moment because the prisons aren't good enough. So if they did have to leave, they would sue us because of human rights abuses.
So it's enormously expensive, but will...
I think it will make its money back because it costs so much to pay for prison here. But then also Cameron, while he was there, made a speech to Parliament and spoke about Britain's pride in abolishing the slave trade. But he dodged calls to apologise and pay reparations, which caused a bit of a row.
So he's set up a prison, but he's not apologised for slavery.
That is the case.
There is a slight sense, isn't there, that he's adding insult to injury.
Well, he said, essentially, that we should all just move on. Because nothing makes anyone feel better more than someone telling them, let's all just move on.
He may as well have said, get over it. And also, I found this amazing. I read this week that Britain's never formally apologised. I don't think anyone's ever formally apologised for slavery, but Britain certainly hasn't. Tony Blair came the closest. He said he had deep sorrow about slavery. Now, why not? I apologise when people bump into me in the streets. Just say sorry. I mean, it's the most British thing possible to say sorry. I mean, I say sorry for stuff I haven't done. If it gives me an easy life, if he doesn't care, just cross his fingers behind his back. I mean, that's been primary school children for decades.
I think the problem, though, is if you apologise for something, genuinely you accept some responsibility for it. Yeah. And that's the problem.
How far would that statute of limitations go back? Because if a lot of Jamaicans sued for compensation for slavery, could we offset that? Because the French must owe us quite a lot for the Norman invasion.
Surely. Yeah.
I mean, it was slavery, you know, we were very guilty and lots of big towns, Bristol, Liverpool.
Now, look, if you're prepared to take the blame... OK, you're not that generous to people on the street, but you're sorry for what happened years ago. Yeah. Do you think you'd be more likely to own up to something if there was the possibility that as a result of it you would be sent to prison in Jamaica?
Why are you looking at me?
I can't answer that question, Andy.
I'd rather just go on holiday in a caravan in Millport than go to prison in Jamaica. And Millport's lovely, but I'd rather go less far away than go to a prison. I wouldn't last long in a prison, Miles. Look at me, I'm gorgeous.
I'd get terrible sunburn.
You don't have to go out at the exercise hour,
no, that's
do you?
True, yeah. Oh, God, and then I'd be very pale.
That's the worst thing ever.
Bewilderingly. Oh, no, that's not going to work. It's got to be a... I'll start all sentences with an actual word. It's these stifling directives from upstairs. Bewilderingly, this is the visit to Jamaica of Prime Minister David Cameron, or as they call him over there, Mr. Jerk Pork. Cameron. Cameron announced plans to build a new prison in Jamaica so that Jamaican citizens who commit crimes in the UK can return home to serve out their sentences. Which means the following will now be a typical conversation in this country. I say, my wife has gone to the West Indies. Jamaica? Yes, that's her country of origin. It's where she's been forcibly deported by the Home Office. And what's more, she lacks the ground to appeal using the Human Rights Act. Boom, and indeed, if you will, tish. Cameron said the £25 million prison is proof of our renewed commitment to the region and to Jamaica, because nothing shows you care about a country more than repatriating dangerous criminals to its shores as fast as is decently possible. On the plus side for Britain, there is absolutely no precedent that suggests building a detention centre on an island, forcibly deporting people to it and then not letting them return, has ever caused problems for any other nation. 2 points to Emily. And at the end of round one, the scores are Emily and Ellis have 4, but Andy and Susan have 6. We start round two with a cutting from an article in The Times.
Leading expert Nigel Mercer has described the lack of regulation around cheap and dangerous lip injections as ridiculous. It's happening under our noses, he said.
Thanks to everyone who sent us that. Andy, what's made an unlikely splash?
Oh, there's running water on Mars, and that is going to be a very expensive call-out for a plumber. That's going to be overtime, materials. If he has to go back for tools, that's going to be ridiculous. So in answer to David Bowie's question, it seems that there may well be life on Mars. Probably not enough life for a Ray Bradbury novel. Just sort of very basic organisms, maybe enough for a Dan Brown. And the reason that it's important is that it makes it much more viable for human beings to go to Mars, because it means that on the journey out, the spaceship won't be weighed down by thousands of bottles of Evian. So that would be good. We get there a lot quicker. I mean, I read this and I thought, according to Tomorrow's World, we should have been on Mars years ago. But then I thought they were such a bunch of liars, that lot. I was personally very disappointed when we stopped the missions to the moon. Well, personally for that, I blame Buzz Aldrin. No, because apparently when he got back to Earth, he went round saying, well, it's OK to visit, but there's not a lot there. Nothing to do in the evenings. He only gave it 2 stars on TripAdvisor.
I hope there is life on Mars. I personally will welcome our new Martian overlords, because I think it'll put things into perspective for people.
Do you think they would invade, or do you think that we would sort of get on?
No, we wouldn't get on. They would invade us.
Susan, what a paranoid remark. What about you, Emily? Are you living in fear?
No. Going back to Mars, though. These streaks of water have been found in walls and craters and everything. And we do actually have something to investigate, don't we? We have the Curiosity rover on Mars, but we can't use it because it has to be sterile. It's covered in earthly bugs or something. So they've got to clean it. We've got something on Mars to investigate it, but we can't use it. So that's quite annoying.
But do you know why it is then? What has stipulated the fact that we can't investigate it?
I think it's because it might contaminate the water. Is that?
It's where every country on Earth is bound by the Outer Planetary Treaty from 1967.
Oh, very close, Ellis. Very close. The 1967 Outer Space Treaty.
That's it.
But presumably, when you were first asked to sign, you were like, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. I'll be amazed if any of this comes to pass, but whatever, here we go.
So the Welsh Assembly didn't have to sign it.
You guys can do whatever you want up there. Yeah.
But I'm getting impatient, to be honest, because it's salty water they found. And I had a look at the history of water on Mars, and initially they discovered evidence of ice, ancient ice, and then they discovered ice, and now they've discovered brine. Just get on with it and discover an alien, for crying out loud. Boring.
Yeah. I think when NASA said they had an exciting announcement to make, this is a little bit of an anticlimax, I suppose.
I mean, the people from John West Salmon are absolutely thrilled to bits.
Great, another natural brine source. Yeah. Could we be outsourcing our tin manufacturing?
I think India is sending a mission to Mars as well. So we could find it's being used, you know, to house refugees or to, Donald Trump build a golf course on Mars.
David Cameron will build a prison there. Why not?
It sounds expensive, but in 25 years, all of the Martians that we've expelled there, really, we really will be making our money back. Celestially, this is the news that running water has been found on the surface of Mars, instantly taking it out of the affordable price bracket for most first-time buyers. The water appears in long, dark flows across the surface of Mars, leaves behind it deposits of hydrated salts, and is filled with the natural electrolytes that keep your body feeling revitalised and refreshed. Sorry, I'm just reading this off the back of a bottle I bought in Whole Foods. apparently Gwyneth Paltrow absolutely knocks back this stuff, and it's hard to blame her. The water... The water has left long, dark stains on the rocky terrain, and I'd like to take a moment here to announce that this year's Radio 4 Christmas appeal will be to raise enough money to supply Mars with a set of coasters. No life form, no matter how remote the chances of their existence, deserves to have their table surfaces plagued with stubborn stains. Sadly, the Mars rover, Curiosity, hasn't been able to collect a sample of Martian water because it was never fitted with a cup holder. As is so often the case in life, it's the little things, isn't it? Scientists do their best to sterilise their spacefaring equipment once it arrives at its destination via what has been described as a very intense ultraviolet tanning salon. This has ensured that the rover is useless for actual science but looks absolutely cracking on the beach. 2 points to Andy. Emily, who attacks the most important meal of the day?
Well, this is about an event that happened in Shoreditch this week when hundreds of protesters with torches and pig head masks went on a rampage and threw paint at this place called the Serial Killers Cafe. That's with a C, cereal, breakfast. And they wrote scum on the window. And it was organised by this anarchist group called Class War. The event had the initials FP, but let's call it Duck Parade. For now. And they took offence at this cafe that sells bowls of cereal for between £2.50 and £5 or something. And they don't like it. They are, you know, anti-gentrification. But, you know, I thought, it's funny, isn't it, how this cereal cafe gets a bad rap, really, when you consider what's nearby in the area. You've got a cat cafe down the road.
What are they...
Think there's just cats that you can pet. Well, you'd like it, so
you can rent. You can go for an hour and you pay some money and you pet a cat.
Oh right, but you don't. You don't eat them. I mean, it's.
You don't eat them. You have a cup of tea and you pet a cat. I've been to a few.
What a heartbreaking evening.
But the thing is, they said. I did not agree with this in the slightest, because one of the founders of Class War said that they went for the Serial Killer Cafe because they'd get publicity for it, and they wouldn't go for a Fox News or a Pret. And the thing is, it's a weird thing to pay £5 for a bowl of cereal at 9 o'clock in the evening, but people have been doing weird things for ages. I don't understand why anyone watched Top Gear, but people watched it, so carry on. And they're saying on Sunday they're having another anarchist protest at the Jack the Ripper Museum. Because nothing says anarchy like a well-planned and publicised protest. You know, so they're having an anarchist protest, but they're telling everyone where and when it's happening just so you can all have sandwiches before you turn up.
Yeah, saying that, they've been... My colleague has been writing about this and they've been emailing this duck parade people. And they're really polite and they end their emails, kind regards, duck parade.
Well, they don't like hipsters. That's the because they think it's a sign of gentrification. Have we got any hipsters in?
Oh, bless you, Ellis.
Of course, it's not. Three or four. But
not plastic hipsters, but I should think.
Whenever I meet someone sort of that cool and on the cutting edge of fashion, I always go the other way because it sort of puts my back up. So if they ever ask me what sort of music I like, I'll end up saying things like, well, I find the ever-changing top 10 is pretty exciting, isn't it? And I just love the idea, because obviously it's a very East London thing. You know, you get them in bigger cities like Manchester and stuff now, but it was for ages, it was centred on Shoreditch and Old Street and around there. And so I'd never met one until I moved to London, and I just love the idea of introducing... If my sister went out with one, a hipster meeting my dad, I just love it. What do you do then? Well, because that beard would suggest that you're some sort of reclusive academic. Is that the sort of... You get cheaper car insurance if you're in academia. I hope, welcome to the family. No, I ride a Brompton bike. Oh, we'll have to be covered by home contents insurance, sir. So, what do you do for a living? I'm a self-employed internet startup. Right, I got as far as self-employed and then you sort of lost me.
Do you know who turned up at the cafe to lend their support?
Boris.
I'm confused. Boris turned up, what, after the event?
Not, yes. He was not part of the ride.
Oh, okay. Right, and he... to lend his support?
Yeah. He presumably just sort of stumbled around with his rucksack, knocking milk off the tables and going... He probably did more damage than the riot. Yeah. Christ! Look at this. This guy is absolutely out of control.
And there was that hipster trend. It was called something like neo-normal, where you're so cool.
Normcore,
that's it. Where you're so cool, you dress like your dad is going to a garden centre on Saturday morning, and that is cooler than looking cool.
Well, that's me. That's my whole life.
Yeah.
I am unconsciously been a hipster all my life.
Do you own a fleece?
Yes.
I've
got the beard.
Yeah. You've got the attitude. You've got the skills.
I don't want to be targeted by class war, though. No.
You eat cereal late at night.
Yeah.
Sometimes, it's been known. Usually cheese, but...
Uninspiringly, this was the anti-gentrification attack by protest organisation Classed War against, amongst other things, a cereal cafe in Shoreditch. And almost every single one of those words will have the vast majority of News Quiz listeners rejoicing that they don't live in London. The cafe opened the next morning to a long queue of young people with beards and checked shirts who said that they only ate at places that had been firebombed. The Serial Killer Cafe is on Brick Lane, an area which has a long history of welcoming immigrants escaping persecution. The Huguenots from France, Jews from Russia, Bengalis, Pakistanis, and now hipsters fleeing mum and dad's silent disappointment. Before the Serial Cafe opened, the same property housed a DVD shop. And this, to me, is typical of the way gentrification is destroying traditional British crafts. What happened to the country we used to live in, where you could pop down to your village blacksmith and have him knock you out a copy of The African Queen on his anvil while you wait? 2 points to Emily, and indeed a bonus to Emily for her comprehensive knowledge of niche cafes in the Shoreditch area.
Thank you very much.
Ellis, have a listen to this. You can leave your hat on. You can leave your hat on. Can leave your hand on. Oh, the unmistakable sound of Carmarthen. Ellis, who didn't get to leave their hats on?
Right, that is students at the University of East Anglia. Student union officials at the University of East Anglia, they have banned a Mexican restaurant in Norwich city centre from handing out sombreros to students after branding the marketing stunt racist. And the general manager of Pedro's, which was the name of the restaurant, he insisted that the promotion was meant as a celebration of Mexican culture. But then I found out that he actually called Matthew Ward, so I don't know how much he was Mexican culture. And about once a year, I would say, a story crops up that means I am broadly in tune with the comments on the Daily Mail website. It's the most ridiculous story I've heard for a long time. I accept that the sombrero is a stereotype, Mexican stereotype, but it's not a historic tool of oppression. It's a hat. You know, I mean, by that logic, a burrito is racist.
Distastefully, this is the case of a bunch of students at the University of Life and East Anglia who were given free sombreros by a Mexican restaurant at a Freshers Week event, only to have them confiscated by student union officials on the grounds that they were racially insensitive. In my day, students got upset about tuition fees. I'm so glad they've moved on to something that really matters. Millinery. I think it wasn't racist precisely because it was a Mexican restaurant dishing out the hats. It would have been different if it was an American diner and they were giving out the hats prior to chasing the students before erecting a wall between the students and themselves. Surely the sombreros would be an essential piece of student apparel, if only to cope with the blazing sunshine and tropical heat of Norwich in October. A sombrero's not too bad. It's much more offensive to give students the impression that they'll be able to walk into a job when they graduate. Before we reveal the final scores, has anybody got a cutting they'd like to share? Andy?
This is from Tim Cole, and it is an excerpt from a visitor's guide to a place called Souk. And it says, drive through Souk on any given day, and you will see baseball and soccer games in progress. People hitting a few tennis balls and kids at the skate park.
Susan?
This is from the Richmond and Twickenham Times. It was sent in by lots of people. A Twickenham resident has tackled a rugby fan who was urinating on her drive. The Cole Park Road resident said she confronted one man who she saw urinating in her front garden. She said, I couldn't believe it. I opened the window and shouted, oi, put that penis away. In my work as a nurse, I have dealt with a lot of penises over the years, and I have no problem with them, or with rugby for that matter.
Emily.
This is from Jube Fraser, and it's from The Times. A Scottish town has been named the best place in Britain to see UFOs by the travel guide Wanderlust. Bonnybridge, just outside Falkirk, has an average of 300 sightings a year. Police have suggested alcohol could be a factor in the sightings.
Thank you. And now let's take a look at the final scores, which show that Andy and Susan have 10, but out in front, Emily and Ellis have 11. Before we leave you, here is an extract from a Milton Keynes Council letter sent in by Trevor York in Sherrington.
The way you register to vote is changing. Please provide us with the information requested on the form overleaf by the 16th of October 2015 or the 20th of November 2015, whichever is the earliest.
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Andy Hamilton, Susan Kalman, Emily Ashton and Ellis James. In the chair was Miles Jupp, and the news was read by me, Susan Ray. The chair's script was written by Lucy Clark, John Hunter and James Kettle, with additional material by Sarah Campbell and Tom Wally. The producer was Richard Morris, and it was a BBC Radio comedy production.